loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we continue our regular Friday segment called The Week in Review, where we take a look at the biggest developments in the United States and around the world from the past week.
But before we get to that story, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, the Chinese government reacted yesterday to the arrest in Canada at U.S. request of Huawei chief financial officer Meng Wanzhou on charges of violating U.S. sanctions on Iran. The government-aligned newspaper Global Times called the arrest despicable, and the U.S. Commerce Department began warning American businessmen about travel to China. Meng will be arraigned in Vancouver, but any extradition could take years. Next, the Ecuadorian president, Lenin Moreno, has ramped up pressure on WikiLeaks co-founder Julian Assange to leave his country's embassy in London. Moreno said yesterday that the UK government has agreed to not extradite Assange to any country where he might face the death penalty. But that's a red herring. Assange already has been indicted in the United States, probably for national security crimes, which do not call for the death penalty. Then, today is the 77th anniversary of the Japanese bombing of Pearl Harbor. President Franklin D. Roosevelt called December 7th a date which will live in infamy. It has lived in infamy. But was the bombing of Pearl Harbor an intelligence failure or a pretext for the U.S. to enter the war? And then all major tourist sites in Paris will be closed this weekend as authorities expect what they are calling major violence from anti-government demonstrations. The so-called yellow vest protests have swelled this week even after the government postponed the tax increase that set them off. 89,000 police will be deployed around the country along with armored personnel carriers. And finally, we'll look at the worst, most misleading, funniest, and just plain wrong headlines of the past week. And in other headlines, the United Nations General Assembly voted down a resolution last night condemning the Palestinian organization Hamas. The resolution was sponsored by the United States and required a two-thirds majority to pass. The vote was 87 in favor, 57 opposed, and 33 abstained. Former Secretary of State Rex Tillerson spoke with the press for the first time since leaving office about his tenure in the Trump administration. Speaking to CBS News, Tillerson remarked on how difficult it was to work for, quote, a man who is pretty undisciplined, doesn't like to read, doesn't read briefing reports, doesn't like to get into the details of a lot of things, unquote. Tillerson was replaced earlier this year by former CIA Director Mike Pompeo. Annegret Kramp-Karrenbauer has been elected to succeed Angela Merkel as leader of Germany's ruling party, the Christian Democratic Union. Kramp-Karrenbauer was seen as the candidate of continuity and was favored by Merkel. However, Merkel plans to stay on as chancellor of the country until her term expires in 2021. Fighting in the western Afghan province of Herat intensified last night, with 14 Afghan army soldiers reportedly being killed and 21 captured by the Taliban. The war, now entering its 18th year, is going poorly for Afghan government forces, which now control just slightly over half of the country, according to the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the big stories of the week. It's time for our weekly segment every Friday called The Week in Review. We'll talk about the week in politics, policy, and international affairs with Jacqueline Lookman. She joins us here in the studio. Jacqueline is the editor-in-chief of the Lookman Nation. You can check out their live stream every week on Facebook and YouTube. And we're joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Walter Smolarek. Jacqueline, Walter, welcome.
Thanks.
Happy to be here.
Big events this week. We also see that there are personnel changes coming very soon, maybe today. We pre-recorded this segment at 10 o'clock in the morning Eastern time. You have, of course, the hostage taking, I would call it, of the Chinese financial officer of Huawei Corporation. She was arrested while transferring planes in Vancouver. At the same moment, on the same day that Xi Jinping was meeting with Donald Trump, after which Donald Trump declared a 90-day truce in the trade war. That's an unusual way, Walter, to start a truce, by taking hostages of the corporate leaders of the other side in Canada.
Right. So not only was the arrest done by another country on behalf of the United States, the crime that she's accused of is trading with Iran. But of course, you know, China, as one of the permanent members of the UN Security Council, is a signatory to the Iran nuclear deal.
Let's just go right there, because China, Russia, the other members of the Security Council, and Germany signed an agreement with Iran to limit Iran's nuclear energy program, its civilian nuclear energy program, and to allow very, very intrusive inspections in exchange for the lifting of sanctions. Iran, according to the International Atomic Energy Agency, said Iran was living up to its side of the bargain.
Yep.
China, Russia, Germany, France, the UK also said the same thing. Now we have a Chinese official from Huawei, the largest technology corporation in China, in jail in Canada because they dared to do trade deals with Iran. I mean, it's America that's the lawbreaker here.
Yeah, it absolutely. So what do you do? So how do we connect this with this trade deal that really isn't a trade, that isn't a tariff deal? There's no zero tariffs that China is going to agree to. That hasn't happened yet, but Trump announced it and it sent the markets in a tailspin here in the United States and in China. And that all happens around the same time as this arrest. So it's a really, if you want to make a case for collusion, what else is this? How are we involved in arresting an official in another country who's the head of a corporation? How do we do that?
Right. And, you know, she's such a prominent figure, you know, the chief financial officer, the daughter of the founder and head of the company. And Huawei is like a huge international, you know, here in the United States, we don't necessarily, there's not like Huawei stores on every corner. But I mean, if you look at the global economy, they are the second largest manufacturer of smartphones. And John, what were you saying? You learned they were the largest.
They're the largest, the world's largest producer and supplier of internet hardware.
Wow.
The machines that actually make the internet run.
Yeah, like if China arrested Jeff Bezos while he was switching planes in like Paris or something, right?
Well, it would be just like
that. Yeah, it's the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, imagine what the U.S. response would be.
In this hour called The Week in Review, we're going to keep switching back and forth between international foreign policy issues and domestic issues. A lot happened, including even on the ongoing electoral front from the November midterm elections. There's a lot of clamor right now for a redo of the North Carolina election because of the allegations of fraud. What's that about, Jackie?
The election in the 9th district in North Carolina between Mark Harris and Dan McReady, it's one of those elections that's just never ending because of this issue of voter fraud that, honestly, the Democrats paid no attention to. So now you've got situations that were as egregious as, like, people going to people's houses, knocking on their doors and saying, hey, do you have an absentee ballot? Oh, you don't have to go to the polls. Let me take that for you. And actually filling out the ballot for the Republican and taking it to. And so now I think it was McCready who first conceded, but then
he's the Democrat.
But then as the ballots were going through the recount, he came within 900 votes.
Yeah. He's currently 905 behind.
Right. So now he's rescinded his concession. He's unconceded himself. And now there is this focus on this massive voter fraud. Well, not, I'm sorry, it's not voter fraud. It's election fraud, because it's not that voters were voting twice or, you know, voting in someone else's name. It is that this is another instance of a political party tampering with an election domestically in this country, trying to influence an outcome.
And the kicker here is that Mark Harris, the Republican, the incumbent Republican, apparently knew that this was taking place and met with a woman who was sort of overseeing this whole thing. And he denied it, but other staff members have come out and said, no, she was in the office. We saw the meeting. So, you know, a do-over, which hasn't been done since the New Hampshire Senate race in 1974 when it was a tie.
Yeah.
A do-over is very unusual, but it looks like that's where we're headed.
I think legally they don't have a choice.
Right. And that's the best case scenario for the Republicans, because it seems pretty clear that a crime's been committed here.
Yeah.
And frankly, I think Mark Harris is going to be lucky, or should count himself as lucky, if he's not prosecuted.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how this plays out, especially in light of what's going on in Michigan and Wisconsin, where outgoing Republicans are literally changing the laws to limit the power of the Democrats.
I want to go to Wisconsin and go to those other situations. But first, the Charlotte Observer, the leading newspaper in Charlotte, North Carolina, has called for a redo.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's pretty big.
Yeah. It's the biggest and most important paper in the state.
Yeah. I don't know. Make a prediction, John. Do you think it'll happen?
I mean, I do. I think they're going to have to do a revote.
Wow.
Yeah, definitely.
And like I say, there's a precedent for it. It's very, very unusual. But in 1974, in New Hampshire, a Senate race ended in a tie with more than 250,000 people voting. An actual tie. And several months passed. They counted and recounted and re-recounted. And they had a do-over. And then the Democrat ended up winning by a few votes. John Durkin.
Let's go to Wisconsin. Some people are calling it a legislative coup d'etat by a lame duck Congress, or state assembly. Yeah, this is happening. Again, Scott Walker, the governor, the outgoing Republican governor, very right wing, very famous or infamous, depending on how you see it.
And very angry because he just lost re-election.
He lost re-election. The question is whether he'll actually sign these laws. Let's just talk first what they are. Go ahead, Jackie.
Yeah, so apparently they did this in like this marathon all-night session in Wisconsin. So what happens in these bills is that they limit the power of the incoming governor to appoint people to key positions. I think they eliminated one entire position altogether so that the incoming Democrat couldn't fill that position. Over 80 judges that Wisconsin had not even bothered to appoint over the past, 2 years, all of a sudden, overnight, they were all approved. Scott Walker's picks. So Walker and the Republican legislature in Wisconsin in one night has pretty much solidified the power of the Republicans, even as they lost the race and the incoming Democrat comes in. So he can't fill any of these positions. He cannot set a course for his own administration. Now, the question is it legal? And if, I don't know that it's going to stand up to a legal challenge. But then the bigger issue is that the Republicans have done this against the will of the voters. And these are the people who for years and years and years have been telling us that they are the party of freedom and democracy and liberty. But they basically spat in the eye of all of those things in Wisconsin. And Wisconsin did it first. And then Michigan, with the same situation where the Republican lost, said, hey, we can do that. And then they did the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, there was only one state senator that voted against this from the Republican Party. There was just one. I read an article in which he was interviewed for the Milwaukee Journal last night. And the vote in the Senate was close. It was 17 to 15. The Republicans, as Brian mentioned, control both houses of the legislature in Wisconsin. But the vote was something like 73 to 27 in the Republican controlled House, which is veto proof. The fight is in the Senate. And when asked why he voted with the Democrats on this, and he was the only Republican that did, he said it was just patently unfair. And, you know, politics is cyclical. What goes around comes around. And that pendulum is going to swing in the opposite direction. And the Republicans are going to get bitten by this. And then they're going to jump up and down and shout that it's anti-democratic when they were the ones who started.
Well, let's put it in some historical context, too, because Wisconsin has been, you know, it's been a scene of battle, of political fighting for the past 8-10 years. We had, Walter, the uprising of young people, really, and the labor movement in 2011. And that was because Governor Walker, in this very strong pro-labor state, was stripping workers of collective bargaining agreements, basically a union busting executive orders, or maybe they were being rammed through the state assembly, I can't remember. But people rose up. They took over the state capitol building in Madison. They were thousands in number, tens of thousands at some points. That was at the same time that there was the Egyptian revolution taking place, the Arab Spring, and we had people in Egypt, in Cairo, in Tahrir Square, ordering pizzas to send to the demonstrators in the state capitol in Madison, Wisconsin, to show solidarity. So there was a lot of international sort of talk about this is a new movement. This is the 2011 was declared by Time magazine the year of the protester, because you had the Arab Spring, you had Madison, you also had the Occupy movement, which came a few months later. That was, people forget that. That was all in 2011. That was September 17th, 2011, when Occupy started. Again, I think Occupy, the Occupy movement, which spread like wildfire around the country, really was in some ways inspired by what happened in Wisconsin at that state Capitol building. But Walter, at the end of the day, then the Democrats decided, let's not keep up the mass protest. Let's have a recall vote of Scott Walker. And they lost.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of harvesting the momentum of people in the streets, they took it back, as the Democrats traditionally do, into safer, that is respectable, that is controllable environments. And it actually backfired. Anyway, let's talk about the history of Wisconsin.
Yeah, it's so important. And I mean, if we even want to draw further back into history, I mean, there's the progressives around La Follette. There's the quote-unquote sewer socialists. Sewer because the socialists who are elected to public office in many, many different parts of Wisconsin to very prominent positions focused on, you know, improving municipal services and were very popular. But I completely agree with your, you know, assessment that the Wisconsin labor protests and youth protests against the attack on the labor movement it was really the beginning of the Occupy movement in the United States, because really, you know, Occupy was the U.S. manifestation of this global phenomenon in 2010, 2011 that's usually referred to as like the movement of the squares, meaning that people, huge numbers of people would go into the big public squares of major cities and protest inequality, basically. And so that's, you know, Wisconsin was the first time that that happened, right? It was an ongoing occupation of, you know, tens of thousands of people, you know, completely taking over the state Capitol building. And it was a legislative measure. It wasn't an executive order, because the reason why that movement was so effective is that they literally took over the state Capitol building so that the legislature could not meet and pass this, you know, horrific legislation. It's like a pretty amazing sight of progressive struggle. And that sort of reintroduced, you know, like class struggle politics in the United States for that had been totally dormant for a really long time.
Yeah, and I think that was a great point, what you said about the reintroduction of class struggle politics. This is also this whole power grab in Wisconsin and Michigan. It's definitely efforts by the GOP to get rid of the ACA on the state level. Number one. Number two, they're also introducing more restrictive voter ID and voter suppression measures on the state level. But it's also a clear repudiation of, and we've seen this throughout history, of the class solidarity that happens in these types of grassroots movements, where working class people from all over the spectrum get together and realize, no, we do have the power to take you down and to stop you. And this is the GOP's last, you know, this is the GOP elite, the business class saying, no, we're not going to let you do it.
I want to read a little bit from the Wisconsin Historical Society called, it's a entry called Milwaukee Sewer Socialism, just for our listeners who might not know that in the United States of America, there was a very vibrant socialist movement. Huge, actually. It was the Socialist Party. It was the Industrial Workers of the World, the IWW, the Wobblies. And there was the Communist Party, which in the 1930s, by 1936, had a membership of 100,000 members, and had a membership of 100,000 members in 1945, right before the witch hunt started. While early 20th century politics were largely associated with the Progressive Party, this is from the Wisconsin Historical Society, it was also the era of socialism in Milwaukee, often referred to as sewer socialism for their back-to-basic strategy. Milwaukee socialists sought to reform the legacy of the Industrial Revolution on the local level by cleaning up neighborhoods and factories with new sanitation systems, municipally owned water and power systems, community parks, and improved education systems. Now, if you told most people during the last 70 years of the Cold War that this was a big part of how urban America came into the modern era was through the work of socialists, people would think, no, you must be talking about Russia or France.
People also don't realize that things like the Tennessee Valley Authority was socialist, mm-hmm. or the Social Security system is mm-hmm. socialist, or any number of very wildly popular government programs. And then, you know, you hear people complain about, I remember sitting next to a senior citizen, I guess I'll call her, at a dinner one night, a family dinner. And she said to me, this is in the beginning of the Obama administration. She said, I think this country's turning into a socialistic country. And just to kind of hit her, I said, oh, I agree. We need to stop this socialism. I said, Social Security is just welfare for people who were too stupid or too lazy to save for their own retirements. Of course, I don't believe that at all. And she was appalled. I said, well, it's socialist after all. It's just free money for old people, right? You're right. Americans don't understand.
Yeah, because it became dangerous to be a socialist.
That's right.
It became dangerous to associate somehow with socialism. America, it has a separation of church and state, Walter, but there is an unofficial religion that was created in 1946 called anti-communism. And everybody had to bow before the altar of anti-communism. People were even afraid to sign petitions for a nuclear freeze or to get rid of the bomb, the atomic bomb in the early 1960s, because maybe a socialist group or a communist group or a front group of one of those parties had initiated this peace campaign. People were truly afraid because that's the impact of a religious fervor. When you're not part of the official religion, you're afraid that you can be tagged. If you're not part of the witch hunt, you might be a witch.
Yeah, and then, you know, after the Soviet Union and its allied governments were overthrown in the late 80s, early 1990s, then it went even a step further and they said, okay, well, that's all in the past now. It's the end of history, right? The famous, you know, Francis Fukuyama, who's a right-wing philosopher, would say, you know, this is the end. There's no more struggle. There's no, you know, capitalism and liberal democracy will rule forever. And like when I went to school, you know, they didn't really even say the word socialism. They said, you know, there's two different types of economies. There's free enterprise economies, and then there are command economies. So like there's this effort to totally exercise like the word socialism from the political lexicon.
And yet, Walter, those dangerous socialist ideas crept into your brain.
Yeah.
One more thought on socialism. I probably shouldn't spend time reading people's Facebook memes, but I can't help myself.
Because they're so attractive.
A lot of my friends complain about socialism with these, what they think are catchy little, you know, one sentence or two sentence memes. Like, why is this caravan coming here? Why don't they go to their socialist paradise, Venezuela? And then when I commented that, you know, they actually are going to the socialist paradise of Sweden, right? Which can't even handle all of the refugees. The people jump all over me. Oh, Sweden's not socialist, it's capitalist.
Well, you know, that's the thing. There's a lot about definition here because, again, because socialism was purged as a term. Like if you ask Bernie Sanders what's socialism, he'll point to Scandinavia. If you talk to somebody else, they'll say, well, it's Cuba or China or, you know, there's a failure to actually define or understand socialism. And then you have groups like in Spain, like the Socialist Party, which is actually to the right of the left parties. And so even though in America it might sound like a left party, it's actually not a left party. So there's a lot of confusion about socialism, Walter. But the thing that I think is interesting, really interesting, and Jackie, you mentioned the ACA and how the Republicans in Wisconsin are basically trying to do away with expanded Medicaid and the other provisions of the Affordable Care Act, the Obamacare. It's when Obama introduced the Affordable Care Act, which was Mitt Romney's Republican health care plan for Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. The Republicans then denounced it and called it socialist. And all these young people said, well, what's that? Right. And they went to the Merriam-Webster dictionary and they started looking up socialism. And it became the most popular search term in Merriam-Webster. I think the law of unintended consequences, one of the reasons why there is, in fact, a revival of socialism.
Yeah, I think if you go to like a party with young people at it in any major city in the country, it's way more controversial to say that you're a Republican than you're a communist. Like, for sure, you would be like way more likely to get into an argument with somebody if you say you're a Republican.
Who are you calling a Republican?
That's true. That's definitely true.
I'm no Republican. I'm a socialist. Doggone it.
I want to switch up before we go to break. It appears that we're going to have a new attorney general. Yes, Jeff Sessions. Arch racist, segregationist, xenophobe, Trump appointee who Trump got mad at because he recused himself in the Russia probe. He's gone, but we may have somebody new coming. What do we know about him, John Kiriakou?
We know a lot about William Barr. William Barr, in my view, is a dangerous guy. He used to be Assistant Attorney General for the Office of Legal Counsel, which is a crazy powerful position within the Justice Department. It was in that position that he wrote the legal memos approving of, from a legal standpoint, the invasion of Panama under George H.W. Bush and the capture and rendition of Manuel Noriega, who was the leader of Panama at the time. He went on to make legal justifications for something that was controversial at the time and is at least as controversial now, and that is the right, I use that in quotation marks, of the FBI to go to another country, kidnap someone, and bring them back to the United States for trial. If they, even if they didn't commit the crime in the United States, if they committed a crime against an American anywhere in the world, the FBI has the right to snatch them off the street in their country and bring them back here. He also spent 2 years on a state board of directors. He was appointed by the then Republican governor of Virginia, George Allen, to serve on a panel that ended up ending probation and parole in the state of Virginia. So if you're sentenced to 5 years in Virginia for a crime, you do 5 years.
You do the whole five.
The whole thing. You get no good time off. You get no nothing. That was his idea.
We're going to come back and talk more about Barr and what he stands for and what it might mean for the people of this country after a short break. He wrote the book, literally. He wrote a document, literally, a book in 1992 called The Case for More Incarceration. That's our new attorney general. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
It's Friday. It's time for our weekly segment, The Week in Review. We're going to continue in the second half hour to look at the big stories of the week and some of the big stories from today. We'll talk about the week in politics, policy, and international affairs with Jacqueline Lookman. She joins us here in the studio. Jacqueline is the editor-in-chief of Lookman Nation. You can check out their live stream every week on Facebook and YouTube. And we're also joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Walter Smolarek. Jackie, Walter, welcome back again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're talking about the new attorney general. It's not confirmed yet.
Not confirmed
yet. It's not quite official yet.
No.
Well,
yeah.
Donald Trump just said it to reporters as he was leaving the White House.
Yeah. Okay. So presume it's
true.
But
he's not been confirmed by the Senate.
Right.
Okay, Jackie, before we went to break, I said he wrote a document in 1992 called The Case for More Incarceration. Mm-hmm. That's what you want. You want the government and the governmental leaders to coin on a greater incarceration, a greater imprisonment of their own people.
Yep. I mean, this, if he is in fact the nominee for attorney general, he will get confirmed. I'm just going to make that prediction right now. He's going to get confirmed because he is the archetype of the law and order conservative that they want, you know, in this position. He wrote that book. And he also made this case saying that violent crime can only be reduced by expanding federal and state prisons to jail habitual violent offenders. I mean, this not only plays into, you know, the conservative law and order types, but this also makes the investors in the prison industrial complex in this country and ALEC very, very happy.
And he's attracted Democrats. When he became deputy attorney general under George H.W. Bush, and he went to the Hill to have his hearings before the Senate Judiciary Committee, the then chairman, Joe Biden, fawned all over him.
Wow.
And said, even though they disagree on the abortion issue, he said, I laud your willingness to answer the question when so many nominees come here and don't answer the question. He said, I disagree with you on abortion. But not only did Biden vote yes, every single Democrat in the Senate voted yes, and he was unanimously approved as deputy.
Wait, that's the bygone era of decency and civility in Washington.
Yes, that's what they mean by decency and civility. I mean, sit there in your confirmation hearing and espouse your horrible, racist, sexist, you know, homophobic views on actual policy. But if you do it nicely and actually answer all the questions, that's okay. You can have the job.
Biden said that in an interview, that I don't like his politics, but he's very nice and he has a great sense of humor.
So what if he's going to rip the rights of women to control their own bodies?
Exactly.
He's so nice. And guess what? They're both part of the two ruling class parties.
Yes.
That's the monopoly in political power. If you want to talk about meddling in actual democracy, it's almost impossible for third parties independent parties, be they, you know, libertarians or green socialist parties, to stand a chance, because you don't have the money, you don't have the billions of dollars that you need from corporate America, you don't get the free media time. And then each state has laws that are constructed by Democrats and Republicans that make it almost impossible for independents to get on the ballot. And then they're excluded from the debates.
Yep.
So the people can't actually hear them. And then we're talking about, and I'm sick and tired, Walter, of all these liberals and so-called progressives who are crying about the meddling in our democracy by Russia or somebody else. This isn't really a democracy. It really is a plutocracy. It has some democratic forms, but it's a plutocracy.
Well, and Brian, just to make matters worse, and I know that you enjoy hearing about backgrounds like this. After he left government in 1992, he became the general counsel at Verizon and then was promoted to vice president and general counsel. After that, he became a member of the board of directors of Time Warner and then went on to Kirkland & Ellis, where he was one of the senior most partners. So this guy is the child of corporate America. This is exactly the kind of person that we talk about on this show all the time.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, I mean, when Donald Trump first came into office, it was really surprising to everybody that he picked people who were themselves just like corporate executives, right, to be mm-hmm. in the government, which is traditionally something that they don't like to do, because then, you know, it becomes more likely that their dirty laundry gets aired. But somebody like Barr, you know, he knows what he's doing. There's sort of like there's obviously a revolving door. I mean, there's so many other examples of this. The head of the FCC, Ajit Pai, right, who is the former general counsel at Verizon. Yeah. I mean, this is actually how the U.S. government operates.
Yeah.
Not a democracy, a plutocracy, meaning of, by, and for wealth, of, by, and for wealth. I'm looking at this paper. This guy is a maniac.
Yeah.
Which is why he will be the attorney general of the United States. Here's October 28th, 1992, William P. Barr. In July, I released a report entitled Combating Violent Crime, 24 Recommendations to Strengthen Criminal Justice, setting forth a comprehensive strategy for making state criminal justice systems more effective in achieving their central purpose, the protection of our citizens. And then it goes on, of course, we cannot incapacitate these criminals, just generic criminals, unless we build sufficient prison and jail space to house them. Revolving door justice resulting from inadequate prison and jail space breeds disrespect for the law and places our citizens at risk unnecessarily of becoming victims of violent crime. So what's he saying? We don't have enough prisons. You're not saying, hey, we don't have enough colleges.
Right.
Not saying,
right.
Hey, we don't have enough decent paying jobs.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, we don't have enough recreational centers. We don't have enough decent education so that working class kids
job training
can thrive. Mm-hmm. That's not the problem. The problem is we just don't have enough damn prisons. And that's what we have to start to do. That was 1992.
Let me add to that, too. Other conservatives, people like Richard Viguerie, if you remember Richard Viguerie, one of the most prominent independent conservatives of the Reagan era, has come out strongly in the form of op-eds in both the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal as saying that they were just simply wrong about building more prisons. Even conservatives have walked away from this notion that we need more prisons. He's a throwback. Barr's a throwback to the bad old days of the 1980s, and his ideology has never been updated.
Yeah.
You know, Jackie, it took 200 years from the birth of the nation, 1783, when the Articles of Confederation were signed following the American War of Independence. It took from 1783, it took 200 years for the United States incarceration rate to reach the 1 million number.
Mm-hmm.
In the next 20 years, it reached the 2 million number. In other words, it was a planned, dynamic policy to lock people up.
Yep.
And of course, it was mainly working class people, disproportionately young black people, mm-hmm. young Latino people, mm-hmm. but poor people in general.
Yeah.
This guy, Barr, is one of the reasons the United States has the largest number of people in prison
mm-hmm.
compared to any other country in the world. His idea was to craft mass incarceration, and now we, working class communities in particular, black communities in particular, mm-hmm. are living with mass incarceration.
Absolutely. And this is the problem that so many people in my generation, especially black people who grew up in poor neighborhoods in my generation, had with this whole whitewashing of the legacy of George W. Bush. Because even if you didn't know that William Barr was behind a lot of those policies, you knew what came out of the Bush administration in your neighborhood, just like we knew the what came out of the Clinton administration. It was the same policy. And then when we look at how poor people, Black people, Latinos, you know, poor white people even are disproportionately targeted by the people who make money off of mass incarceration, not just the prison corporations, but the phone service providers. Now, you know, the food service providers, the commissary providers, everybody who makes money off of locking people up for inordinately long periods of time for nonviolent offenses. You see that it's not just a money-making venture. It's obscene that it is a money-making venture on locking people up instead of providing opportunities for people to live a decent life. But you also see it's like a mindset of getting rid of undesirable people, because this is the same guy whose policy it was to indefinitely inter, well, not inter because they didn't bury, they didn't kill them, but indefinitely house Haitian immigrants in Guantanamo Bay, because they were afraid that they all had HIV/AIDS.
Yeah.
He's also the guy who expelled 129 Cuban refugees,
yes,
calling them violent criminals.
Yes. So this is a mindset of how these people deal with who they consider undesirable people in this country.
Yeah, you know, there was just a study that came out either today or yesterday. It was by Cornell University, and it's a stunning statistic. So half of all U.S. adults have had an immediate family member who is incarcerated, you know, for at least one night, or, you know, in most cases for a lot longer than that. And then, you know, the study also reveals, you know, the intense racism that's involved in the mass incarceration system, because it found that among African-Americans and Native Americans, that's 63% of people know somebody who have been incarcerated, 48% for Latinos, 42% of white people. It's enormous, right? Because even though, you know, okay, so the number of people in prison is about 1% of the U.S. population. That's massive compared to, like, pretty much every other country on the planet. But then it ripples out from there until you get to, you know, half of people know somebody who's been locked up. And actually, not just know somebody, has an immediate family member.
Yeah. Right.
One out of every four prisoners in the world is a prisoner in the United States. The United States has 6% of the world's population, but one out of every four prisoners in the world is in the United States. And, you know, we're talking about the big stories of the week. And of course, this might be the big story of today about Barr and his role in the creation of the system of mass incarceration. But it's also, of course, the week in which George H.W. Bush died. Now, that was the George H.W. Bush Justice Department that Barr was part of.
Right.
But we talked earlier, John, and I just want to flag it again because it's such an amazing moment. In September 1989, George H.W. Bush held up in the White House at a press conference, or at a press national TV offering from the president. He held up a bag of crack cocaine. He said, "This is crack cocaine," he solemnly announced, holding up the plastic bag. "It was seized a few days ago in a park across the street from the White House. It could easily have been heroin or PCP." And then he was making the point, this is how dangerous drugs are in America, that it's right across the street from the White House. But then, and I'm looking at an article from September 22nd, 1989 by Michael Isikoff for the Washington Post, Isikoff makes the point, the DEA called this young man up, a teenager here in Washington, D.C., and lured him to Lafayette Park, where they then bought the crack from him. The kid did not even know where the White House is. He said, "Where the F is the White House?" when they were trying to get him to come. They set him up. They busted him there so that Bush could use him as basically a prop, and use this bag of cocaine as a prop. That kid went to prison.
10 years in prison.
Yeah.
And this was a political stunt by George H.W. Bush. Again, let's go back to the bygone era of decency and civility. That's what we've heard all week long. Here's the president of the United States luring a teenager from a working class African-American neighborhood in Washington, D.C., or the Bush's agent luring them there so they can bust him and send him to prison so that Bush can have a press conference and enact new laws that really created the system of mass incarceration such that one out of every four prisoners in the world is in the United States jail.
Yeah, and we shouldn't place all of the blame on him. Bill Clinton played his role, too.
Major, the 1994 law.
That's right. But the bottom line is that this was George H.W. Bush's idea with the help of William Barr. And we're going to return to those bad old days because you know that Donald Trump is going to do as he's told when it comes to these issues that he doesn't fully understand.
And I think the interesting thing about this story of this kid who was used and set up this way, he grew up in the neighborhood I grew up in. I mean, he grew up in Southeast D.C. People don't understand how small D.C. is. We live in Southeast D.C. literally 10 miles from the capital of the United States. Like 5 minutes from my house, you can drive up to Naylor Road and Southern Avenue and sit at the top of the hill and you can see the Capitol.
Yep.
And we also recognize that the people who work in that building 10 miles from us have no connection to the people who live in our neighborhood.
Well, what they do have is they have a high-paid job. Mm-hmm. They have great health care.
Mm-hmm.
Their kids are going to go to college.
Right.
They have everything that they basically need. I mean, that's the thing about American society. There's all this talk about, you know, we're all equal, we're all created equal, blah, blah, blah. The fact of the matter is the top 20% of the country, those who are the top 20% income earners, they basically do have what they need.
Mm-hmm.
If their kids are having trouble in school, they're going to get a tutor.
Right.
Those kids are going to get into college for sure. Those families also have health care. They're not unable to go to a doctor when their kids are sick. They're going to go to a doctor. And then the Congress, of course, is from that 20%. How many members of Congress, say, make $30,047, which is the median income for 90% of Americans? The answer to that would be zero. I mean, we have a Congress, again, of, by, and for wealth, and very happy to incarcerate poor and working class people and demonize them. If their own kids get in trouble with the law, oh, wait, I forgot, affluent suburban kids don't do anything wrong.
Or when they do, they get the best lawyers money
can buy. They get the best lawyers, of course. They don't get arrested because there's no police, you know, pounding down on them like there are in working class and Black and Latino communities.
Exactly.
There's not over-policing. If they get, quote, in trouble, they're going to have a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be their records will be expunged. This is a class-based system. We talked about class in the beginning, in the first half hour. That's what we're looking at.
Yeah, right. I mean, instead of, you know, luring a Black working class teenager to the White House to get, you know, their drugs that they need for a prop, well, they could have, you know, raided a dorm room at Harvard or Yale or, you know, any elite university. Mm-hmm. And I bet they would get a lot more drugs there.
Right down the street at GW.
Yeah. Again, let's go back. It's not Republicans. It's not just Trump. It is the system, and it is the Democratic Party. John pointed out Biden's role in all of this. Of course, without the Democrats, we wouldn't have Clarence Thomas.
And that was also Biden. Biden was the chairman of the committee at that time.
Yeah, absolutely.
They put down Anita Hill and the other women who wanted to come forward and testify. They made sure that Clarence Thomas got to be the Supreme Court justice. You can rant and rave about his ultra-right rulings afterwards, but without the Democratic Party, Clarence Thomas would not be a Supreme Court justice. Again, 1994, the Violent Crime Control and Law Enforcement Act that came after Barr. Well, who signed that into law? That would be Bill Clinton.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I mean, that was such an accelerant to mass incarceration, a minimum sentencing where judges have no discretion, the three strike rules. I mean, all of these kind of systems whereby people who are selling drugs, even small amounts of marijuana, are getting sent to prison. Now marijuana is being legalized. You're going to have rich white men and corporations make a lot of money off of marijuana or other drugs. But the kids who sold drugs 15 years ago, they're still in prison.
Right.
They are still in prison and they're not coming out of prison. Nobody's giving them relief right now.
Yeah. I mean, the interesting thing about that time, and I'm so glad we're having this conversation because it's weird thinking about it. That I lived it. Like, I was a part of the neighborhood watch group in my neighborhood. We were the Orange Hats. We got money from Mary and Barry for walkie talkies and stuff like that. And it was, you know, it was a great community building exercise. And there was a problem with violent crime in the neighborhood at the time that we wanted to be
addressed.
And there
was a problem with crack.
There was a problem with crack. Not going to sit here and say that that wasn't a problem and that we didn't need help with that. But here's what happened that we tried to tell people was going on that nobody believed. We would sit on our little corner that we were patrolling and the D.C. police, a couple of D.C. police were assigned to us for our protection. And cars all night long would drive up to the corner. We lived on a back street. We lived on a back street off a back street that nobody knew was there unless you lived in that neighborhood. I swear it was in the cut. And cars would drive up to that corner all night long, and they were all from Maryland and Virginia. They were all white people, almost all of them white people. So we would sit down and take license plate numbers. And we would go to our community meetings every month that we would have with the police chief of 7th District every month. And we would give him this list of license plate numbers. And at one meeting, he said, just exasperated, "What is it that you all want me to do with these?" And we're like, "Are you kidding? These people are coming into our neighborhood buying drugs." He's like, "I cannot do anything with these people. We cannot arrest them." And we just sat there and we said, "Wait a minute. So you can bring the National Guard into our neighborhoods with floodlights and military weaponry, but you can't arrest the people who are in the neighborhood coming into our neighborhood to buy drugs. Are you kidding me with that?" And then it comes out, I think, in the Washington Post a little while later, that there was this understanding between D.C. police and Maryland and Virginia politicians that D.C. police could not arrest Virginia residents who were coming into specific neighborhoods to buy drugs.
Yeah, the crack epidemic became a thing of utility for law enforcement to create this system of mass incarceration. It was real. I lived in Washington in 1988 and 89. On my block,
I did too.
On 15th Street, you could every 10 feet, there was somebody selling crack.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was all over. But what was not discussed much at that time, but Gary Webb tried to bring it out, was that the U.S. government wasn't completely opposed to crack and is certainly not opposed to it being sold in black communities.
Right.
And certainly not opposed if some of their international allies, like their allies who were fighting against the Sandinistas in Nicaragua, were profiting from crack cocaine and the cocaine business. Because after Congress passed a law that made it the Boland Amendment, that made it impossible for the U.S. government to keep funding the Contras, they had to get money from somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of the story, John.
Sure it is. And Gary Webb took his own life because the Washington Post and the New York Times tried their hardest to discredit him because he came out and wrote that report.
Yeah, I encourage people to read the story about Gary Webb.
Yeah, there was a
the
terrific,
tragedy.
There was a terrific movie, too, and book, Kill the Messenger.
Kill the Messenger. Amazing.
I'm proud to say that I was a consultant on the film.
Oh,
and
wonderful.
The film, it held closely to the book. Don't miss it.
Yeah. Let's turn in our last couple minutes, Walter, other big events this week. Perhaps the biggest in the Americas this week was the inauguration of a new and progressive president in Mexico, López Obrador. I mean, this is huge. I mean, the tide in Latin America has been moving to the right the last few years. Now you have Mexico, the 14th biggest economy in the world, maybe the second largest trade partner with the United States, a big country with a progressive president. It could really be a sea change in terms of politics, not simply for Mexico, but for the Americas.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And, you know, Obrador really, truly has a mandate. I mean, he won the election. Mexico doesn't have runoff elections. So, you know, it's just whoever gets the most vote in the first round. And there were, you know, several major candidates. But Obrador still managed to get a majority, you know, a slight majority in the first round. It's, you know, unprecedented, really, in modern Mexican political history for somebody to be like this popular. And so, you know, his agenda that he's laid out, you know, in his inauguration speech and in the couple of days after that, it's really remarkable. I mean, it's like a reorientation of the country's economy. He denounced neoliberalism. He said, we're going to have, you know, massive public investment in education and guaranteeing jobs for people. We're going to have popular consultations to determine the future of infrastructure projects that, you know, might damage the environment or, you know, people in the affected areas wouldn't be for. Like there's an airport whose construction was canceled, you know, giving into a longstanding demand of the people who lived around there as a consequence of one of these referendums. And then there's also the reorientation of the country's security policy where, you know, where in the past, the military, the Mexican like regular army was enforcing the law. Now he's saying, you know, well, we're going to have a National Guard that's going to be more trained in human rights. We're going to have, you know, maybe the legalization of certain drugs, maybe, you know, a general amnesty or, you know, peace, you know, basically like peace and reconciliation commissions where, you know, the drug war that's caused so much death and destruction could come to an end and, you know, Mexican society could be rebuilt on a more progressive basis. So I think it's very impressive.
You know, Jackie, the war on drugs that the Mexican government, the pro-American reactionary governments have embraced, 120,000 people were killed in that war as of 2013. I don't know what the number is now, but it's gone up a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not an effective, if it's a war, it's not an effective war. And the people who are dying, the people who are losing their lives are the people.
Yeah, absolutely.
It just doesn't work. Mexico has to go in a different direction. And I have to say, the same problems that we talked about earlier with the systems of mass incarceration were exported to Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
They don't solve social problems. They don't solve the problems of crime. They do either lead to a lot of imprisonment or to a lot of just death.
Yeah, a lot of chaos and a lot of violence, a lot of influence in government by violent drug cartels that are profiting off of the demand for drugs that comes from this country. It's great that AMLO, as his nickname is refocusing the law enforcement apparatus in Mexico, and that's wonderful. But unless the demand part of that equation is changed from this country, he's still going to have an issue on his hand with the influence of the cartels, because their money, they're not going to let their money stream be challenged. So then, you know, we don't have an administration right now that wants to do anything about actually addressing solid, real alternatives or real problem solve solutions, rather, to the drug issue, which is, we all know, good jobs, quality housing, education, and mental health and substance abuse assistance.
In our last 3 minutes, let's talk about, again, it's a breaking story. And we're, as we told our audience in the beginning, we pre-recorded this segment Friday morning between 10 and 11 a.m. But Heather Nauert, who is right now the spokesperson for the State Department, may be the next U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. Nikki Haley, I don't know. Nikki Haley was a monster at the United Nations, threatening and bullying everybody.
Utterly unqualified. And if it's possible, Heather Nauert is less qualified than Nikki Haley was.
Yeah.
I mean, just think of the people who are U.S. ambassadors to the U.N. John Bolton, he was...
Gene Kirkpatrick.
Indeed. Let's talk about Heather Nauert. I mean, what's the credentials here?
She is a longtime Fox News anchor and news reader. Before that, she was a Fox News reporter. And that's pretty much it. She went to the State Department as the Assistant Secretary for Public Affairs and Public Outreach, which is a relatively new position. Nobody's really sure what those people do other than run the daily press briefings. And that's it. Like, literally, that's it.
Does it matter, Walter?
I think this is a completely smart and good choice by Donald Trump when you're an administration who totally opposes the United Nations as an institution and thinks it's just sort of like an unnecessary fetter on U.S. power, you can do two things. You could do like George W. Bush did and appoint somebody like John Bolton, who's highly competent as sort of like a bureaucratic fighter to undermine the institution. He'll be actually good at sort of like undermining the institution itself of the United Nations. Or you could decide, hey, we're just going to use this as like a platform, like a media platform, to put on a show for the world and flex our muscles and talk about how tough we are. And Heather Nauert is, you know, she's an effective like presenter. You know, I mean, she has lots of experience with that. She was on Fox, you know, every day for years. And, you know, Donald Trump thinks that she does a good job as the State Department spokesperson. And so, yeah, I mean, she's an actress, effectively, and that's kind of what they want. I totally think it makes sense for them.
There's something here we should be watching, too, because Nikki Haley, in her position as UN ambassador, has cabinet status, right? She sits in on cabinet meetings. She's considered to be the same as any secretary of whatever department. The president has not said that he will allow cabinet level status for Heather Nauert. And so what people are speculating is that the president cares so little about the United Nations that he doesn't need anybody to articulate policy, because he'll articulate the policy.
Heather Nauert said this as State Department spokeswoman: "We have a very strong relationship with the government of Germany. Looking back in the history books, today is the 71st anniversary of the speech that launched the Marshall Plan. Tomorrow is the anniversary of the D-Day invasion." So, of course, Walter, the invasion was against Germany. And against the then existing government of Germany, Hitler, and of course, many, many Germans died as a consequence of that invasion. I don't know, it seems weird.
I am so confused by that.
The Marshall Plan, just for our audience, the Marshall Plan was after the United States and its allies defeated Germany, the United States resuscitated German capitalism and European capitalism through the Marshall Plan and created these new governments. But this would be a different government than the government that the United States had quote, a relationship with on the D-Day invasion. Anyway, we're completely out of time. We were joined in studio by Jacqueline Lookman. She is the co-editor of Lookman Nation. You can see their live stream every week on YouTube and Facebook. And we were also joined in studio by Walter Smolarek. He is a Sputnik News analyst. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, Community Public Radio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.